Welcome to Nocturnal Tales. Tonight begins, as true mysteries often do, on a railway platform, Charing Cross, a mild September evening, and a lady in grey who looks over her shoulder as if a shadow were following. Within days, Hercule Poirot and Captain Hastings are drawn to Greybourne Court, where whispers of a double, a dangerous substitution, and a certain troubling signature hint at a design both patient and cruel. This is the silent signature, told in homage to Agatha Christie's spirit, yet entirely our own. Before we begin, tell us in the comments, where in the world are you listening from tonight? We love seeing this map of mystery light up across the globe. Producing these tales, writing, narrating, illustrating, takes many hours, and your backing helps us keep the standard high. If you'd like to support the work, you can join our membership for ad-free listening and exclusive stories, or leave a small tip. If not today, your listening, your comment below, and a share are already support in its truest form. Now, let the story unfold. Chapter 1. The Lady on the Platform. If there is one thing that travelling with Hercule Poirot has taught me, it is that life's greatest mysteries rarely announce themselves with the fanfare one might expect. They creep in quietly, through an overheard phrase, an unaccountable expression, or the peculiar manner of a stranger glimpsed in passing. It was on a mild September evening in 1928 that such a mystery found us. We had just concluded a small but satisfying case in Devon, the affair of the missing black pearls, as Poirot would no doubt entitle it when he came to write it up, and were returning to London in high spirits. Our journey had been uneventful, the train smooth and punctual, and I was looking forward to a quiet dinner and an early night. Charing Cross Station was its usual evening self, the hiss of steam, the shuffle of passengers hurrying for their connections, and the faint smell of hot metal mingled with coal smoke. Poirot, immaculate as always in his grey suit and bowler hat, consulted his pocket watch and declared we had 20 minutes before our connection to Folkestone, a short seaside holiday, having been prescribed to him by his doctor for nerves, though I suspected it was merely an excuse to avoid the fogs of London. It was while idly scanning the platform that I saw her. She stood near the bookstall, half in shadow cast by an overhanging advertisement for Piers Soap. At first glance there was nothing remarkable. A young woman of perhaps 22 or 23, in a plain travelling costume of grey serge. But there was something in the way she moved that caught my attention. A slight, involuntary flinch each time someone brushed past. The quick, searching glances over her shoulder. And, perhaps most telling, the way she clutched a small reticule to her chest, as though it were her last possession in the world. Her clothing puzzled me. The coat and skirt were neat but plainly cut, the sort worn by a governess or lady's companion, and yet her shoes, well made, of fine kid leather, were those of a woman accustomed to better things. Her hat was a trifle askew, one glove buttoned, the other missing entirely. "Mon ami," came Poirot's voice at my shoulder. "You have the air of the hunter who has just sighted the deer." "I was only noticing that young woman," I replied. "She seems anxious." Poirot followed my gaze, his head tilting slightly. "Tiens, more than anxious, I think. You see the pallor beneath the powder? The way she moves without direction, as one who does not know whether to advance or retreat. And Hastings, note the small details. The fine shoes, the hat worn carelessly, the mismatched gloves. A lady in reduced circumstances, perhaps in distress, yet not accustomed to the servile trades." "Really, Poirot," I said with a laugh, "you make her sound like the heroine of a novel." He smiled faintly. "Perhaps she is, mon ami, and perhaps the novel is of the kind where the last chapter is not yet written. At that moment, as if sensing our scrutiny, she looked directly at us. Her eyes, large, gray, and full of an appeal I cannot quite describe, met mine for the briefest instant. She opened her mouth as though to speak, but then her gaze darted past me and all color drained from her face. I turned quickly, but saw only the milling crowd. When I looked back, she was already moving away, walking swiftly down the platform towards a waiting train. Without luggage, she stepped into a second-class carriage and disappeared. Poirot watched her go, his brows drawn together. She fears someone, that much is certain. "Shall we follow her?" I asked, my curiosity piqued. Poirot shook his head. "Non, Hastings. One does not chase the butterfly. One waits, and it will return if it is meant to. Besides," he tapped his temple, "I have already fixed her image here. Should our paths cross again, I will know her instantly." The incident might have faded from my mind had it not been for what happened a week later. We had just finished breakfast at our rooms in Whitehaven Mansions, when Mrs. Pearson, our landlady, entered with a look of barely suppressed curiosity.
"A young lady to see you, sir," she said to Poirot.
"Looks fair worn out, she does, and says it's urgent." Poirot's eyes lit up with the quiet satisfaction of a man who has been proved right. "Show her in, if you please, Mrs. Pearson." The door opened, and there she was, the same grey-clad figure from Charing Cross. Her hat was gone, her hair slightly disordered, and there was a smudge of dust on her cheek, as though she had walked a long way. She came forward, hands clasped tightly. "Monsieur Poirot," she began in a low, urgent voice, "I have come to beg for your help. My name is Miss Alice Harcourt, and I believe I am in mortal danger." Chapter 2. The Confession of Miss Harcourt. It is not often that one sees Hercule Poirot abandon his usual ceremonious greeting and sit forward in his chair with genuine, almost boyish eagerness, but the reappearance of the lady in grey had that effect. "Pray be seated, mademoiselle," he said, motioning her to the armchair opposite his desk. "You are fatigued, a tisane, perhaps. Hastings, my friend, be so good as to ring for some hot water." Miss Harcourt shook her head. "No, thank you. I have not much time." She spoke in a hurried, breathless manner, as if every moment spent in our rooms might be shortening her life. Poirot regarded her steadily, his fingertips pressed together. "Calm yourself. We have, I assure you, all the time that is necessary. Begin at the beginning, if you please." She glanced nervously toward the window, then back to Poirot. "You saw me last week at Charing Cross. I had meant to speak to you then, but—" her voice faltered. "I was being followed."
"Followed? By whom?" I asked, leaning forward.
"I do not know his name. A man, tall, thin, with an odd limp. He has been watching me for weeks. Sometimes I see him in the street. Sometimes—" she shivered. "Sometimes I wake at night convinced he is in the house." Poirot nodded gravely, as though this were the most natural statement in the world. "And the reason for this attention? It is not that you are a celebrated film star, I presume." Her lips curved faintly, but the smile died at once. "No, I am, or rather I was, the ward of Sir Charles Harcourt of Greybourne Court in Kent. My parents died when I was a child. Sir Charles was my guardian, and I believed until recently that he intended to leave me a portion of his estate." Poirot's eyes flickered. "Until recently?" She drew in a deep breath. "3 months ago, Sir Charles announced my engagement to his godson, Mr. Leonard Westridge. I had not been consulted." "Arranged marriages are not so common in England these days," I remarked.
"It was not quite that," she said quickly. "Leonard is handsome, charming, but there is something—"
she broke off, groping for words.
"He is too eager, too smooth, and since the engagement was announced I have learned things about his debts, his friendships, his temper.
And what was your response? Poirot asked.
I told Sir Charles I could not marry him. 2 days later I received a letter, unsigned, warning me to think again, for your life depends upon it. I let out an involuntary exclamation, but Poirot simply inclined his head.
And then, mademoiselle?
Then, she continued in a low voice, something far stranger occurred. One evening, as I was returning from the village, a woman stepped out from behind the hedgerow. She wore a coarse cloak, and her face was partly hidden by a scarf, but I could see her eyes. They were... She hesitated. Monsieur Poirot, they were my eyes. I do not mean merely the same color. I mean my own face, my own features, looking back at me. It was like staring into a mirror. I confess I stared at her, utterly bewildered.
You mean she was your twin?
I have no twin, Miss Harcourt said firmly. I have no sisters at all. Yet this woman was my height, my age, and so like me that for a moment I thought I was dreaming. She pressed something into my hand, a scrap of paper, and whispered, "They will call me Alice Harcourt. Do not let them. Protect yourself." And then she was gone, running across the field before I could speak. Poirot was watching her closely now, his head slightly to one side.
And the paper?
I still have it. She reached into her reticule and produced a small, much-folded note. Poirot took it delicately between thumb and forefinger, unfolding it on the desk. The handwriting was uneven, as though scrawled in haste. "Beware of Leonard Westridge. They mean to lock you away." Poirot tapped the note thoughtfully.
"Eh bien, this is a most singular situation."
I, on the other hand, felt I had all the makings of a lurid melodrama. "It's some sort of trick, obviously," I said. "Someone means to impersonate you and claim your inheritance." Miss Harcourt's hands tightened in her lap. "That is precisely what I fear, Captain Hastings, and if I am correct, they will have to dispose of me to succeed." Poirot sat back, his eyes half closed.
"And so you came to me?"
"Yes. I have heard you are the only man in England who can untangle the truth when all seems lost." Poirot's expression softened.
"Mademoiselle, you do me too much honor. But you are wise to seek assistance. We shall go to Greybourne Court together, n'est-ce pas, Hastings?"
I blinked.
"When?"
"Tomorrow morning, mon ami. There is no time to lose, for if our lady in grey is to be replaced by another..." His gaze shifted to Miss Harcourt, and his voice dropped to a murmur. "Then perhaps the machinery of that substitution is already in motion."
Chapter 3. Greybourne Court.
Greybourne Court received us with the dignity of an old country house, discreetly prosperous, and faintly oppressive with the weight of family tradition. Sir Charles Harcourt himself awaited us in the hall. He was tall, erect, and carried his years with a severe grace, though the lines about his mouth suggested that life had demanded more of him than he cared to admit.
"My dear Alice," he said, as he took his ward's hand in both of his, "you have caused us much concern. London is no place for a young woman alone." Alice murmured a reply, but his gaze had already shifted to us.
"And these gentlemen?"
Poirot bowed.
"Hercule Poirot, at your service. And this is my friend, Captain Hastings. We are here because Mademoiselle believed she required assistance."
Sir Charles' eyes rested on Poirot with a courteous gravity.
"I have heard of you, monsieur. Your reputation has reached even the Kentish countryside, but I must tell you frankly, matters of this household are best dealt with within it."
"My ward is impressionable. She has, I fear, allowed her imagination to run away with her." I saw Alice stiffen, but Poirot only inclined his head, unruffled.
"Imagination, sir, is often the herald of truth."
Sir Charles did not answer directly, but turned to Alice with a kindly firmness.
"You are overtired, child. We shall speak later.
In the meantime, you must forgive me, Monsieur Poirot, if I appear cautious. Hospitality is gladly given, but I must hope you will not mistake our private difficulties for a problem worthy of your great talents." It was politely said, but there was no mistaking the dismissal beneath the words. Poirot merely smiled and twirled a waxed end of his moustache. We were not left long before Mr. Leonard Westridge appeared. He entered with the assurance of a man who expects to be welcome everywhere, greeted Sir Charles with easy familiarity, and then turned to Alice with a proprietary air that made me bridle on her behalf. "My dear Alice," he said, taking her hand, "how good it is to see you restored to us. We have all been so anxious. Sir Charles, you must agree the colour is coming back to her cheeks." Alice withdrew her hand at once. "I did not leave on account of my health, Leonard." "No?" His smile was indulgent. "Then some trifling alarm, I suppose. A face glimpsed in shadow. A note slipped beneath a door. Rural imaginations are easily excited." "That will do, Leonard," said Sir Charles with quiet authority. "Your cousin has been unsettled. We will not add to it with speculation." It was at that moment Lady Frances Harcourt drifted in, languid and exquisite in pale silks, as though the effort of appearing were accomplishment enough. "My dear," she said to her husband, "you did not tell me Alice had returned, and with guests no less. Monsieur Poirot, I presume?" She gave him her hand with the faintest smile. "One hears of you everywhere. I only hope Alice has not wearied you with her nervous fancies." Poirot bowed. "Madame, the fancies of a young lady are sometimes more substantial than they appear." Lady Frances raised her brows slightly. "How very continental!" Sir Charles interposed smoothly. "We are agreed that Alice requires rest. That is all that need be said for the present." It was all masterfully done. Courteous, civilized, and yet shutting every door at the same time. Dinner was served with all the ceremony of a country seat, conscious of its dignity. The table glittered with silver, the footmen moved with solemn precision, and Sir Charles presided as though the order of the meal itself were a statement of his authority. Conversation was courteous but stilted. Sir Charles inquired after our journey, spoke briefly of the harvest, and directed one or two mild remarks to Poirot on the subject of Belgium. Leonard filled the pauses with easy chatter, racing, politics, plans for improvements to the estate. Alice answered only when directly addressed, her manner composed but distant. Lady Frances contributed very little, save the occasional languid observation that hovered somewhere between amusement and disdain. At length Leonard turned directly to Alice. "You will be glad, I think, when we have settled things, my dear. This period of uncertainty cannot be pleasant for you." Alice's colour rose. "I have told you, Leonard, that there is nothing to settle." Sir Charles set down his knife with deliberation. "That is enough." His glance was firm, and Alice fell silent, though her eyes flashed. Poirot, who had been trifling with his glass of claret, spoke very gently. "Forgive me, Sir Charles. But one cannot help observing that the young lady is disturbed. Disturbance of the mind is not to be cured by silence." Sir Charles's reply was calm, almost urbane. "Monsieur Poirot, I am obliged to you, but as guardian I must decide what is best for my ward. If her nerves are unstrung, rest and good order will restore them more surely than inquiries that lead nowhere." Poirot bowed slightly, as if conceding the point, though I knew that look in his eye. When Poirot appeared to retreat, it usually meant he was preparing to advance. After dinner, we gathered in the drawing-room. A great fire burned in the grate, throwing flickering light on the portraits above. Lady Frances reclined on a chaise, apparently absorbed in a novel. Leonard leaned against the mantelpiece, too perfectly at ease. Alice sat by the fire, her hands folded in her lap, her gaze fixed on the flames. Sir Charles took up his customary position, standing with one elbow on the mantel, the very picture of patriarchal composure.
It was into this tableau that Mrs. Withers entered with the tea tray. She had the stern air of a servant who knows the traditions of the house and keeps them intact. She had just set the tray down when she gave a small, startled cry.
"Miss Alice, how did you contrive to be here already?"
Alice looked up in astonishment. "I beg your pardon, Mrs. Withers." "I left you but now upstairs, miss, by the window in your chamber. You were in your grey dress, looking out at the gardens. You turned your head when I spoke, though you gave no answer." There was a silence. Alice rose slowly. "I have not left this room since dinner." Sir Charles spoke at once, his tone firm. "Mrs. Withers, you are mistaken. My niece has been with us here throughout." The housekeeper stood her ground. "With respect, sir, I know Miss Alice when I see her. If it was not she, then it was—" She stopped, her face paling. Leonard gave a short, dismissive laugh. "An overworked servant, a shadow, a trick of the light. Greyborn's corridors play these pranks often enough." Lady Frances turned a page of her novel, smiling faintly. "How very diverting. A household ghost at last." Sir Charles' voice cut across the room. "That will do. I will hear no more of it." Poirot, who had been stirring his tea with great care, set down the spoon. His voice was very quiet. "Nevertheless, monsieur, what Mrs. Withers has described is of interest. For if another walks in Mademoiselle's likeness, then the danger is no longer imagined. It is here." No one answered. The clock ticked loudly on the mantel, and in that moment even I felt the weight of Greybourne Court close about us, as though the very walls were listening. Chapter 4. Private Conversations. The next morning dawned bright and sharp, a mist lying low on the parkland beyond the windows. Greybourne Court, for all its grandeur, seemed to me less a home than a fortress, each inhabitant guarding his or her position behind walls of civility. After breakfast, Sir Charles requested a word with Poirot in the library. I accompanied them, though I sensed my presence was merely tolerated. The room, with its sombre rows of law books and the faint smell of leather and tobacco, suited its master perfectly. Sir Charles stood by the hearth, his tall figure outlined against the carved mantel. "Monsieur Poirot," he said gravely, "I must speak plainly. Alice has placed herself in your hands. I do not impugn your motives, but I must caution you. She is young, high-strung, and inclined to romantic imaginings. It is of the utmost importance that such fancies are not encouraged." Poirot inclined his head politely. "I comprehend perfectly, monsieur. Yet one asks, when a young lady sees before her own likeness, so exact that it deceives even her closest servant, is that a fancy only?" Sir Charles's gaze hardened. "Mrs. Withers has served this family faithfully for 30 years, but she is not infallible. In country houses, gossip travels faster than fact. I am determined that no whisper of this absurd story should escape these walls. Reputations are not so easily mended once they are torn." "Reputation, yes," murmured Poirot. "It is a delicate thing." Sir Charles continued, his tone clipped. "You will oblige me, Monsieur Poirot, by confining your inquiries. No questions to villagers, no appeals to the servants' hall. I will not have Greybourne made a spectacle." I could not help protesting. "But surely, Sir Charles, if Miss Harcourt believes herself in danger—" "She believes too much, Captain Hastings," he interrupted with a sudden sharpness. Then, softening, he added, "I mean only that her nerves are overstrained. Rest, quiet, and proper guidance will restore her. That is all." Poirot rose, bowing slightly. "Naturally, monsieur, you wish for tranquillity. Yet sometimes the truth disturbs before it soothes." Sir Charles made no reply, and we withdrew. Later in the morning we encountered Leonard Westridge in the smoking room, impeccably dressed, the newspaper spread before him. He rose at once, all charm. "Ah, our celebrated detective. And, Captain Hastings, pray sit down. A cigarette?" Poirot declined with a little smile.
"You must find our dramas amusing, Monsieur Poirot," Leonard went on. "A vanished apparition, an overwrought young lady, and now you, to give consequence to it all. I trust you are not disappointed with our little stage." Poirot's eyes twinkled.
"On the contrary, monsieur, one finds the actors most interesting. You, for instance, speak always with assurance, yet assurance may sometimes hide unease."
Leonard laughed lightly.
"You suggest I am nervous? My dear sir, I am the most fortunate of men. Sir Charles has honored me with his trust. Alice is shortly to be my wife."
"That," interrupted Poirot very gently, "is not yet agreed, I think." For the first time, Leonard's smile stiffened. He lit another cigarette, exhaling slowly. "Alice is young. Young women are prone to fancies. In time, she will recognize where her true advantage lies. A marriage between us is both natural and inevitable."
Poirot inclined his head. "And the debts, monsieur?"
Leonard gave a short laugh. "My dear Poirot, every man of spirit has debts. They are the oil that greases the wheels of society. Sir Charles is fully aware of mine and sees no cause for alarm."
It was well said, but I could not help thinking his tone a shade too emphatic. Poirot asked nothing further, merely thanked him and left him to his paper.
Our final conversation of that morning was with Lady Frances. We found her in the morning room, languidly turning the pages of a fashion journal. She looked up with that faint, mocking smile that never quite reached her eyes.
"So, Monsieur Poirot, you pursue your inquiries? How energetic of you. I do hope Alice has not led you too far astray."
Poirot bowed.
"Mademoiselle is anxious, madame. I seek only to reassure her."
"Reassurance," Lady Frances murmured. "How desirable, and how elusive. My stepdaughter has always been fanciful. As a child, she was convinced the West Wing was haunted. I remember her in floods of tears because she had glimpsed a figure in white. It was a housemaid, of course."
Poirot regarded her steadily.
"You do not believe what Mrs. Withers saw last night?"
Lady Frances shrugged her delicate shoulders.
"I believe Mrs. Withers is devoted. Devotion can mislead the eye. And if Alice herself thinks she has a double, well, the mind is capable of strange tricks."
"Yet," said Poirot softly, "you do not deny the possibility."
There was a pause. Lady Frances's eyes met his coolly. "I neither affirm nor deny. I merely observe that in this house one learns discretion. There are matters, Monsieur Poirot, which are better left unspoken."
With that, she returned to her magazine, dismissing us as effectively as her husband had done. That evening, when we were alone, I said to Poirot,
"Well, they've told you very little, I think.
Sir Charles wants silence. Leonard insists on inevitability. Lady Frances shrugs it all away. It seems a dead end."
Poirot, seated by the fire, shook his head.
"Ah, Hastings, you see nothing.
And that is well. It preserves for me the pleasure of explanation. Consider, when each person counsels silence, yet in a different key, what does it mean? Sir Charles speaks to preserve dignity, Leonard to conceal urgency, Lady Frances to avoid entanglement. Three silences, Hastings, and not one of them the same. It is most illuminating."
He leaned forward, his eyes suddenly grave.
"And meanwhile, somewhere within these walls, walks the shadow of Alice Harcourt."
Chapter 5. The Matter of the Signature. The next day brought movement. The first decisive movement since our arrival. It began with a letter. Mrs. Withers, who never allowed the Morning Post to be handled by any hands but her own, brought in the salver with an agitation she made little effort to conceal. Sir Charles took his correspondence, broke the seal of one envelope, and frowned. He read the sheet through twice, then folded it with excessive care.
"Alice," he said, "you were in Maidstone yesterday afternoon."
She looked at him steadily.
"No, uncle."
He held out the letter.
"The manager of Farley and Company, bankers, is good enough to confirm that you called to withdraw a sum from your account. A small one, but the point is the visit.
His voice remained even, but there was iron beneath it. "You will not deny your signature." Alice did not touch the paper. "I did not go to Maidstone. I did not sign anything."
Leonard, who had been buttering toast, laughed softly. "Banks do not mistake faces, my dear girl."
Poirot's little hand interposed delicately.
"With your permission, Sir Charles?"
He took the letter to the window. Blue-black ink. The tail of the H in Harcourt is longer than usual. The downstrokes rather tremble. "Curious."
Sir Charles's eyes were fixed on Alice. "You will oblige me by explaining this, child."
"There is nothing to explain," she said very quietly.
Lady Frances, who had not yet honoured the post with a glance, murmured, "One cannot be in two places at once, unless one is a rumour."
Sir Charles folded his arms. "I shall go to the bank this morning."
Poirot bowed. "Permit that I accompany you, monsieur. A detective has his little vanities."
We found the manager of Farley and Company a precise gentleman with pale eyelashes, and a manner suggesting that nothing could astonish him, chiefly because he had long ceased to notice anything. He confirmed, with unruffled civility, that Miss Harcourt had presented herself the previous afternoon, accompanied by another lady, had produced her passbook, and withdrawn £10.
"Would you be so obliging," said Poirot, "as to tell me, was the lady companion known to you?"
The manager considered.
"Not to me, sir. Quietly dressed. A veil."
"And the signature?" asked Sir Charles, his jaw set like iron.
The passbook was produced, a counterfoil laid beside it. Poirot bent over both with minute care, tilting them towards the light.
"It is a good imitation," he said at last, his voice almost reflective. The manager stiffened.
"We are satisfied, sir, that the drawer was Miss Harcourt."
"Because," murmured Poirot, "you looked at the face."
The gentleman drew himself up.
"Naturally."
Poirot inclined his head.
"Nature, monsieur, is sometimes the enemy of accuracy."
We left with little gained, but the chill conviction that the deception was systematic. On the way back, passing through the High Street, we encountered the postmistress, a stout woman with a resolute chin. She greeted Sir Charles with proper deference, then turned to me with a nod of recognition.
"Your young lady was in again yesterday," she said briskly.
"Back so soon?"
Sir Charles stopped dead.
"What do you mean?"
"Miss Harcourt," said the woman confidently, "collected a registered packet at 4 o'clock. Signed for it neat and proper. A. Harcourt."
Poirot's eyes grew suddenly bright.
"Madame, would it fatigue you to describe the gown?"
"Grey," said the woman promptly. "Neat, well made. A little bunch of violets at the breast. Gloves to match."
"And the voice?" Poirot asked.
"Soft," she answered after a moment, as though she feared to raise it above a whisper.
"A wise precaution," murmured Poirot.
Sir Charles's face had grown very grim. He said nothing on the drive back, nor did Poirot. I myself was at a loss for words, and as I glanced across the car, I saw Sir Charles's gloved hands tighten upon the head of his stick until the knuckles showed white.
Poirot asked leave to see Alice's wardrobe that afternoon. Mrs. Withers attended us, outraged but loyal, as he examined gowns and shoes with the air of a connoisseur contemplating pictures. He paused over the grey dress Alice had worn the evening of our arrival.
"You permit," he said.
"Ah, the hem has been lengthened and let down again. See, Hastings, the faint line where the press has not quite erased the former fold. And here, the hook is new. The thread has not darkened with wear."
Mrs. Withers bridled.
"I altered it myself last spring, sir."
"Just so," said Poirot, and his forefinger hovered a moment above the collar.
"One more trifle. The scent. Mademoiselle wears nothing."
Alice shook her head.
"Never."
"And yet," said Poirot, bending, "there clings to the lining a ghost of—"
"What is it?"
"Not violet," Heliotrope? No. A modern bouquet. Strong at first, then cloying. It is not of the quality Mrs. Withers would suffer in this house.
Mrs. Withers drew herself up.
We are not a perfumery, sir.
Poirot's eye twinkled.
No, no. Then it is the scent of the other. The lady who walks in Mademoiselle's likeness.
He lifted the hem.
A last trifle. A tiny rent caught with an overseam, not Mrs. Withers' hand. Another stitch lies here over hers.
Alice caught her breath. Then she has worn my dress.
Or another so like that the eye is deceived, said Poirot softly. But I think, yes, she has worn yours.
Mrs. Withers pressed her lips together. I keep the keys, sir. There is no getting into Miss Alice's room without my knowing.
Unless, said Poirot gently, the person entered with your consent.
Mrs. Withers started as if she had been struck.
Never.
Then, more quietly, unless I were deceived.
Just so, said Poirot again. It is the trade of deceivers to trade upon honesty.
He made no comment on the small smear of violet powder he discovered upon the inner cuff, nor upon the faintest trace of black grease about the edge of the left glove, stage grease, if I know anything of such matters, but I observed his nostrils twitch. In the late afternoon, Dr. Crampton called. He was jovial, florid, and professionally soothing.
My dear Miss Harcourt, he said, taking Alice's wrist in plump fingers, these alarms must cease. A little bromide at night. No more of this wandering imagination.
Sir Charles, I advise quiet. A week at St. Oswald's would set her right.
St. Oswald's? I asked.
A private nursing home, said the doctor smoothly. They are discreet. Rest is the thing.
Alice drew her hand away. I shall not go.
Sir Charles's gaze did not waver.
You will do as I think proper, Alice.
Poirot, who had been examining a paper knife with elaborate interest, said without looking up,
Two certificates are required, are they not, Doctor?
Dr. Crampton smiled.
For what, Monsieur Poirot?
For the law to confuse rest with restraint, said Poirot mildly.
The doctor's eyes flickered. We do not speak of restraint.
No, said Poirot, we do not speak of it.
There was a silence.
Then Sir Charles rang.
Francis, be so good as to join us.
Lady Francis entered cool and faintly amused. Sir Charles spoke with grave courtesy. Francis, Dr. Crampton advises a short stay for Alice at St. Oswald's. I propose to take his advice.
Lady Francis's eyelids drooped. If you wish it, Charles.
Alice stood very straight.
I refuse.
Sir Charles's voice remained perfectly courteous.
Your refusal is noted, my dear. I trust you will see reason.
Leonard came in on the tail of this, all concern.
What is this? Alice unwell? My poor girl, you should have told me.
Mr. Westridge, said Poirot, you will forgive a question. At what hour were you yesterday at Maidstone?
Leonard stared.
What an extraordinary inquiry.
At 4, I suppose. Everyone goes at 4.
Everyone, said Poirot, does not sign A. Harcourt.
Leonard laughed, a touch too loudly. Come, sir, this is intolerable.
Intolerable,
repeated Sir Charles with finality.
We will have no more of it.
It was then that the butler entered, discreetly disturbed.
Sir Charles, there is a gentleman in the hall who insists upon seeing you. He gives the name Mr. Nash, clerk to Messrs. Pierman and Nash solicitors.
Show him in, said Sir Charles.
Mr. Nash proved to be a small, dry man whose every word fell with the neatness of a pin upon a cushion. He bowed to Sir Charles, included the rest of us with the edge of a glance.
I beg pardon for intruding, Sir Charles. I am instructed to inquire, for the avoidance of irregularity, whether your ward's marriage by special license is to proceed tomorrow, as per the document lodged with us yesterday.
There was a little pause, like the silence when a string snaps in a quiet room.
My ward's what?
Said Sir Charles very distinctly.
Marriage, Sir Charles,
returned Mr. Nash, unruffled. He produced a paper. "Between Mr. Leonard Westridge and Miss Alice Harcourt, the necessary forms are here with the lady's signature, the license duly paid for in cash. It but remains for me to deliver the license to you, sir, as guardian, and to receive your acknowledgement."
All eyes went to Leonard. He had gone rather pale.
"This is monstrous," said Sir Charles. "I have authorized nothing."
Mr. Nash bowed again. "Then there is the more reason for clarity, Sir Charles. The lady herself was in my office. I recognized her at once from her appearance at the bank earlier. She signed here." He indicated the line. "Alice Harcourt."
Alice spoke very quietly. "That is not my hand." Poirot, without asking leave, took the paper. He bent over it for a long moment, then lifted his gaze to Mr. Nash. "The lady wore a veil."
"She did," said Mr. Nash.
"And smelt faintly," said Poirot, "of a scent that is the despair of men of taste."
Mr. Nash permitted himself the ghost of a smile. "I cannot say, sir."
Sir Charles's control, admirable till now, gave way an inch. "This shall be stopped at once."
Mr. Nash coughed discreetly.
"It can only be stopped, Sir Charles, by your formal objection before the license is issued. I am instructed to deliver the license at 8 this evening."
"Then you will not deliver it," said Sir Charles, in a tone that would have stopped a charge of cavalry.
Mr. Nash bowed.
"As you wish, Sir Charles. But I should tell you, the gentleman has engaged a clergyman who is amenable to expedition."
Leonard found his voice. "Sir Charles, I know nothing of this."
"Sir," said Sir Charles, "you will do me the favor of being silent."
Mr. Nash withdrew with the same neatness with which he had entered. There was a short, deadly quiet. Then Sir Charles turned to the doctor.
"Crampton, arrange the necessary. The child shall not be exposed to further outrage. She will go to St. Oswald's tonight."
Alice stepped back as though he had struck her.
"Uncle!"
Poirot's voice cut across hers, low but very clear. "You will do nothing precipitately, Sir Charles. The trap is nearly closed, but not upon the bird you think."
Sir Charles wheeled. "What do you mean?"
"I mean," said Poirot, "that the lady who calls herself Alice Harcourt has prepared every paper needed to become Mrs. Westridge, while the true Alice is to be removed where her voice cannot be heard."
Leonard burst out, "This is intolerable," and took a step forward. Poirot merely looked at him. He fell back.
Sir Charles rang the bell.
"Barton, the car at once."
It was nearly 8 when the sound of wheels came upon the gravel. I had been with Poirot in his room. He had written 2 notes in his small foreign hand and given them to me with precise instructions. We went down together. At the foot of the stairs stood 2 men in dark coats, strangers, and behind them a closed motor car with a driver in a peaked cap. Dr. Crampton hovered, outwardly genial, inwardly watchful. Lady Frances, pale and very composed, stood a little aside. Sir Charles, rigid as a figure in marble, faced his ward.
"Alice," he said,
and there was no unkindness in his tone, only a grim necessity. "You will come quietly." Alice turned not to him, but to Poirot.
"Monsieur..."
"Courage, mademoiselle," said Poirot softly. "One little moment more." The butler entered with a card on a tray. He crossed to Sir Charles.
"A lady to see Miss Harcourt, sir. She insists. She says the matter will not wait."
"Send her away," said Sir Charles. Poirot took the card from the salver and glanced at it. His eyes flashed.
"No,"
he said in a voice that made even Sir Charles pause. "Admit her." There came into the hall a slight woman in a grey gown and veil, the very image of Alice. She halted, lifted the veil, and for the first time we saw her face fully. Alice gave a low cry. Shock, fear, and something like pity mingled in it. The stranger's eyes went to Sir Charles, then to Leonard, and rested at last on Dr. Crampton. She spoke scarcely above a whisper, yet every word was distinct.
"I have come,"
she said, because I was promised money, and now they will not pay me.
Her gaze swung to Alice, so like, so terribly like. They told me I was to be you.
The men in dark coats moved as one towards Alice. Sir Charles made a swift sign. Leonard took an involuntary step. Dr. Crampton said very smoothly, "This is most unfortunate."
Poirot raised his hand. "Stand where you are. I think, monsieur, we have reached the moment."
And then, whether by chance or design, I cannot say, the hall lamps flickered and went down, and in the half-darkness someone cried out. When the light steadied again, Alice was no longer at Poirot's side, and she was gone.
Chapter 6. The Grey Lady Unmasked. For a few moments the hall was a scene of chaos. Shadows leapt on the panelling, voices cried out, and when the lamp steadied, Alice had vanished from Poirot's side. In her place, the woman in grey still stood with veil lowered, her eyes glinting strangely in the half-light.
"Close the doors," Poirot commanded, his tone cutting across the uproar. "Not one person leaves."
The footman sprang to obey. Sir Charles, his face rigid, looked from one figure to another. "Where is she? Where is Alice?"
"I am here, uncle."
We all turned. Alice came slowly down the staircase, pale but composed, her hand on the balustrade. The lights went out, but Monsieur Poirot's instructions were clear. I followed them.
Sir Charles looked from her to Poirot, bewildered.
"Instructions?"
Poirot bowed slightly. "Just so, monsieur, I had provided for such a little contingency. You recall, Hastings, I wrote two notes. One was to Inspector Graves. He and his men are even now in the rear of the house. The other was to Mademoiselle herself."
When the lights failed, an arrangement prepared, I suspect, by our good doctor, she was to withdraw to safety. Thus we have all our players present, but the victim not imperiled.
Sir Charles swung round to the woman in grey. "Then who is this?"
The impostor threw back her veil defiantly. Her resemblance to Alice was uncanny, the same features, though harder, the same fair colouring, though artfully arranged. Her lips twisted in bitterness. "I am the one they promised to pay," she said, "and now they would cheat me. They told me I was to be Miss Harcourt. I learned her ways, her speech, her very hand. For that, I was to have money. But when I came to collect it, they sent me away." All eyes turned instinctively towards Leonard Westridge and Dr. Crampton. Leonard was white to the lips. The doctor maintained an outward geniality that rang false in the charged air. Poirot stepped forward.
"Voila! The Grey Lady herself unmasks. Not a ghost, not a mad fancy, but an actress, a woman of the theatre, skilled in mimicry. She was brought here by Dr. Crampton, employed to impersonate Alice Harcourt at the bank, at the post office, even at the solicitors. And you, Leonard, supplied the motive. Your debts were pressing, your ambition demanded the Harcourt fortune. A marriage could be arranged, if only the true Alice were set aside."
"That is a lie," Leonard burst out, his voice hoarse. The woman in grey gave a sharp laugh. "Lie! You were the one who put the notes in my hand. You told me the rest would come once the wedding was done."
Sir Charles recoiled.
"Leonard!"
Poirot turned to me.
"Do you know, Hastings, what was the doctor's true motive? Not money only, though some perhaps passed through his hands. No, it was power."
Sir Charles leaned on him.
For every doubt, every weakness, it was the doctor's voice that prevailed.
He tasted that authority, and feared to lose it. With Alice mistress of Greybourne, another physician would have been summoned, another counsellor chosen. And so, to preserve his dominion, Dr. Crampton lent himself to this miserable plot.
Crampton's mask slipped. "Why should I be discarded after 20 years? I was the brain of this household. Without me, Charles could do nothing. I would not see it all swept away by a chit of a girl with romantic notions."
Alice drew back as though struck.
"Romantic notions! You would have shut me away for life to keep your hold over an old man."
Poirot's moustaches bristled.
Voilà, mademoiselle. The true disease was not in you, but in him. Ambition. That is the malady of the doctor. Poirot's voice was grave now. It was a clever plot, monsieur. Too clever. The forged signature. Smooth, but too smooth. The gown. Altered by another hand, not Mrs. Withers. The perfume. Vulgar, cheap, nothing to do with mademoiselle. And the voice, always soft, lest the difference be heard. The details betrayed you. The little grey cells. They never miss such things.
At that moment, Inspector Graves entered, two constables at his back. He nodded to Poirot.
We've had the woman's statement. She has named both Dr. Crampton and Mr. Westridge. It's all written down.
Leonard broke out.
It was Crampton. He devised it all.
The doctor turned on him furiously.
You fool, who needed the money?
Poirot raised his hand.
Spare yourselves, it is finished.
The impostor flung out her arms dramatically. What else could I do? They would have discarded me without a penny. I was promised payment, and I claim it still.
Payment you will not have, said Graves curtly. He motioned to the constables, and they stepped forward.
Poirot inclined his head.
Exit, madame. Your role is finished.
The woman drew down her veil once more and was led away between the policemen. The echo of her footsteps lingered in the hall long after she had gone. Alice shrank back slightly, her face ashen.
To think she could look so like me.
Poirot turned gently.
Resemblance is not identity, mademoiselle. That cannot be stolen.
Graves signalled again, and the doctor, spluttering, was taken into custody alongside Leonard, whose struggles and denials availed him nothing.
Sir Charles spoke at last, hoarse and stricken.
Alice, I would have sent you away. I thought it mercy. My God, I see now it was ruin.
Alice turned to him, her voice trembling but firm. Uncle, I would have borne anything from you, reproach, even anger, but not disbelief. You were ready to think me mad, when all I asked was trust.
Sir Charles spoke at last, his voice heavy.
Alice, I owe you more than I can say.
Poirot's expression softened.
You owe her, monsieur, only this, that henceforth you trust her judgment. She has shown courage enough for any family.
Alice's eyes filled, but she said nothing.
Lady Frances, who had watched the whole scene with the faintest smile, rose and stretched languidly.
Well, Charles, at least it promises to be less dull in future.
Poirot regarded her sternly.
Madame, indifference is a luxury. I would advise you to abandon it.
She merely shrugged and swept from the hall. 2 days later, as we prepared to depart Greybourne, Alice came to us.
I cannot thank you enough, Monsieur Poirot, she said simply. You have saved not only my fortune, but my very self.
Poirot bowed over her hand.
The self, mademoiselle, is indeed the greatest treasure. Guard it well.
As our motor drove down the Long Beach Avenue, I said,
You were magnificent, Poirot. But I confess, I should never have suspected the doctor.
Poirot twinkled.
You never do, Hastings. That is why you are so useful.
And with that enigmatic remark he composed himself, mustaches immaculate, as Greybourne Court receded into the mist behind us.
Epilogue. It was some weeks later in London that I dined with Poirot at our familiar rooms in Whitehaven. A soft rain pattered against the windows, and my friend, immaculate in his evening suit, toyed with a single grape, as though it contained the whole mystery of existence. The Greybourne affair was behind us, though not forgotten. Leonard Westridge had been tried at the Assizes and sentenced to a term of penal servitude. Dr. Crampton fared no better. Stripped of his practice and his reputation, he faced imprisonment and ruin, his name henceforth a byword in the county for treachery in a black coat. As for the woman in grey, she turned out to be a minor actress from the provinces. Her evidence, damning in detail, had sealed the fate of her employers.
Sir Charles Harcourt withdrew from public life. The blow had fallen heavily. His hair seemed whiter, his step slower. Yet he had reconciled himself, I think, to Alice, and she to him. They had been seen together in the village more than once, the old man's hand resting lightly upon her arm. The people said the young mistress of Greybourne had brought warmth back to the house. Lady Frances, true to her nature, departed abroad almost at once. Rumour spoke of the Riviera, then of Vienna, her life a succession of dinner parties and discreet scandals. Greybourne Court for her had always been little more than a stage set upon which to play her languid role. And Alice? She remained at Greybourne, mistress at last of her own fortune. I like to think the experience, bitter though it was, gave her a depth of courage she had not known she possessed. Sir Charles's protection had nearly smothered her. Her enemies had tried to extinguish her. But in the end, she stood in her own right, and no one doubted her strength again. I voiced as much to Poirot that night. He looked at me keenly, his fingers steepled. "Mon cher Hastings, there is only one prison from which escape is truly difficult."
"And which is that?" I asked.
"The prison of mistrust. Sir Charles, in his desire to shield his ward, believed too readily that she must be hidden away. He did not trust her to meet the world. It was his error, but one many commit. Happily, Mademoiselle was strong enough to survive it. That is why I admire her." He smiled, that rare, tender smile of his. "The little grey cells can detect a fraud, mon ami. But only the heart can restore confidence. That was the true victory at Greybourne." I could not better it. Outside, the rain continued to fall, but within, the lamps glowed warmly, and the case of Greybourne Court passed, for us at least, into history. And so our journey from the bustle of Charing Cross to the hush of Greybourne draws to a close. If you've stayed with us to the final word, you are part of what keeps these mysteries alive. Share where you're listening from, leave your thoughts below, and let us know which turn of the puzzle caught your little grey cells. If you'd like to help us craft the next case, you can join our membership for ad-free access and exclusive tales, or leave a one-time tip. And if a contribution isn't for today, your time, your comment, and a share already carry nocturnal tales farther than you'd imagine. Until our next mystery, good night.